My name is Luke Bretherton, and this is the Listen, Organise, Act podcast, which focuses on the history and contemporary practice of organising in democratic politics and transformational change. The podcast is a collaboration between the Industrial Areas Foundation, Duke Divinity School, and the Keenan Institute for Ethics at Duke University. This is the first episode in what is a limited series of conversations with those who do community organising. The specific focus of the series is to help communicate what community organising is about, explore some of its core practices, commitments, and values in a way that provides an accessible supplement to on-the-ground training efforts. The hope is to take advantage of the spoken word format of podcasts to capture something of the oral tradition of community organising. But running alongside this specific focus are two others, one of which is to explore how organising connects democratic politics and religion in constructive ways, as since its origins, the majority of institutions involved in community organising are religious congregations from all faiths. The other is to examine how community organising embodies a distinctive vision and practice of democratic politics, which is vital to foreground in our contemporary moment when democracy itself is seen by many as either an implausible way of solving shared problems ranging from climate change to structural racism, or actively undermined in favor of authoritarian forms of rule. The name of the podcast reflects these concerns, particularly the last one, namely that community organizing embodies an approach to doing democracy well. Through a series of conversations with many different kinds of folk who live and breathe the work of organizing, this series explores how democracy is not first and foremost about a system of government or set of laws or an ideology, but is rooted in three things. The first is a commitment to listen to others different to oneself because their experience, their story, who they are as a person matters. Listening honors fundamental premises of democracy, as it marks a way of respecting the dignity of each individual, the importance of dialogue as against killing and coercion as a means of resolving conflicts, and that people should have a say in decisions that affect them and in shaping the world they live in. The second is that democracy does not just happen. It needs organizing. And if it's to be democratic, it needs people organizing between themselves to determine their living and working conditions. If ordinary people don't get organized, then they are subject to others acting on them and their living and working conditions being determined by systems and structures controlled by others who either don't listen to them, don't have their interests at heart, or are actively hostile to them and want them silenced or disenfranchised. And finally, democracy lives or dies by shared action. Listening and organizing generate the means of coming together, but at a certain point, people must act together to move from the world as it is towards becoming a more just and generous one in which all may flourish. Community organizing as a form of democratic politics embodies these three elements. It begins with listening and has a particular set of practices for organizing people and for generating shared action towards common ends. In this first episode, I talk to Keisha Crum and Mike Geakin about what is community organizing, what does it involve, and why does it matter? Keisha and Mike are two very experienced organizers with the Industrial Areas Foundation, one of the leading networks that does community organizing around the world. Keisha recently became lead organizer with Greater Cleveland Congregations, having been an organizer in Milwaukee for a number of years before that. And Mike has been an organizer for over 40 years, written extensively on organizing and done much to shape its contemporary practice. They will each tell me something of their story as we go along. So join me now for this, the first in a series that explores what is community organizing. So So, Mike, Keisha, welcome to the Listen, Organize, Act podcast. It's great to have you here. A question I start with for folk on this podcast is, tell me a little bit about kind of where you grew up and how you came to be involved in community organizing. Keisha, if we start with you.
Yeah. So, hello, Luke, and thank you for the opportunity. I am Keisha Crum. I am currently the lead organizer of an IAF project in Cleveland called Greater Cleveland Congregations. And I have been organizing with the Industrial Areas Foundation for 20 years. So I was born and raised in Wichita, Kansas, and it was a great town to grow up in. My grandmother moved there from Oklahoma and brought my mother and her siblings. And it was at one time known as the aircraft capital of the world, because there was at least one part of every airplane in the sky was made in Wichita, Kansas. And so it's a manufacturing town. And I grew up in a neighborhood where we were bused to school. And that experience in public school was bittersweet in the sense that our school system was well-funded. And so we had really good sports programs and drama and forensics and art and music, all the things that you think of you would have in a school system, which gave me an opportunity to find sports through basketball and track. And that was something I really held on to, because the other aspects of our public school system was that as African-American students, we were really forgotten about. And it was as if we didn't matter. And I never got in trouble, because that meant my mom would have had to take off of work and catch the bus, and it would have been a lot. So I was a good kid. And the other part of our life was the church I grew up in, New Salem Missionary Baptist Church, which was this institution where my mother and other African Americans that were working class or living in poverty found agency and found joy. They built that church out of their own money, and they created youth programs. When I was, a teen and trying to figure out what I was doing, my mom started a youth group and engaged us. And so I seen this sense of, a world that didn't really want us, but needed us, and an institution that gave agency and joy, which for me set this foundation of, how do I look for those opportunities in my adult life? Which, through all my journeys, I went to seminary, and because my experience in my church and the people that I seen of people of God were people that had joy and had agency. And so I thought I wanted to be a pastor, and went to seminary and learned about community organizing. And it was really through that experience that I got exposed to the IAF and tried to do some neighborhood organizing that was unsuccessful. But the best thing about it was that I went to IAF training in 99, and I learned about this model, and I seen people of faith have joy and agency and actually got things done in their community. And I wanted to learn from people that seemed like they really knew what they were doing and producing. And so 99, I went to training, and then I think in 2000, I think it was 2001, I started organizing in Los Angeles.
Right. How fascinating. So Mike, a little bit of your kind of growing up context and how you got into organizing.
Sure. Thanks, Luke, and good to be with you and Keisha today. Well, I grew up on the west side of Chicago in a neighborhood called West Garfield Park. In Chicago, like in some other cities at the time, people identified by parish, not by neighborhood. So we were in Our Lady of the Angels Parish, which became famous and tragic in a terrible school fire there. 92 children killed, 3 nuns killed when I was in the school there. It was a working class, ethnic, blue collar, Italian, Croatian. We're Croatians. My dad's a Croatian immigrant. My mother was conceived in Yugoslavia, born in the U.S. when her mother came over. So I grew up in that kind of setting. My dad was a World War II veteran, badly wounded in the war. Worked in a number of different jobs, construction, security guard, various things. My mother was worked in the office of a toy company called Tootsie Toy. And both places where my parents worked, you could see from our window for most of our lives. It was that kind of world. Then beginning in about 1965, when I was in high school, I was in a Jesuit Catholic high school in Chicago, St. Ignatius. I got exposed mostly by accident to a number of ways that people organized. So the first way, we were taken by our Jesuit instructors to civil rights actions in Chicago, events. And those were remarkable, incredible, unbelievably violent, unbelievable reaction. When people say, have you ever seen it this bad, given what happened last week in Washington, I said, I up to last Wednesday, I said, I've seen it worse. And as of last Wednesday, I now say, I've seen it as bad. So I saw that and was experienced it and was deeply moved by it, impressed by it. So that was number one. The second was when our neighborhood was racially panic peddled and when realtors came out and scared white families out. My mother tried to put together a little civic group to stop the panic peddling and the block busting. And then when the neighborhood totally resegregated and we were the last and only white family, she then, with her African-American neighbors, put together a little association to try to keep the neighborhood in decent shape. So I saw an attempt at civic organizing just by watching my mother and my neighbors. And then the third thing I saw was the Cook County Democratic machine, which beat both. Blocked and obstructed and undermined the civil rights movement in Chicago, overwhelmed, destroyed, crushed neighborhood after neighborhood. So I saw that in action. And then the fourth thing, this is all between 1965 and 1970. I mean, it was just summers in college, I worked with the Contract Buyers League, which Alinsky did not like and didn't think would work, as it turned out. One of the many times he was wrong, by the way, which was led by African-American homeowners who had been forced to buy their homes on contract, and by a Catholic priest named Monsignor Jack Egan, famous Catholic priest at the time, and a Jesuit seminarian named Jack McNamara. And so I saw an early version of an attempt at a kind of a power something, part civic, part mixed. So, you know, just kind of by accident and by being taken to things and by seeing my mother and her neighbors and our neighbors, I knew there was something here called organizing. I didn't know it was something you did for a living. I didn't know. I knew I had that in my mind so that when I graduated from college and did a few other things, in the back of my mind was always, I wonder if you can do that for work. I mean, I wonder if that's work, you know, for pay, like so that you can survive as well as do it. So eventually I found my way in 1976 to the IAF and worked with them. I worked with the IAF for all these years. Semi-retired about 20 months ago, which is becoming a lot less semi during this period. So that's how I found it.
Right. Oh, fantastic. They're both wonderful, wonderful stories with some kind of overlapping themes. So you've both been involved in community organizing for many years now. So Keisha, let me ask you, you must get this question the whole time when you're kind of starting out in a place and or you're just kind of meeting people for the first time. How do you answer this question? What is community organizing?
Yeah, so I was sitting in a room of a new pastor that had just came to the city of Milwaukee, and we were trying to recruit them into our organization because they were a really established African-American church, actually the oldest in the state. And so she asked me, she's like, what do you guys do? And I said, well, I said, Pastor Joy, I teach people how to fight to create change for the common good. And that's simply what it is. But I think the other part is really about teaching people how to organize power. Right. One of the things that I seen in the community I grew up in is while we had agency and joy, we didn't have a lot of power to really shape our own destiny as a community and as a group. And that what I love about this work is that we have the opportunity, if we find the leaders that are committed to relationships and building power, to do that and to get into the kinds of campaigns where we can begin to reshape our communities around the things that we see as important for not just our people, but for the common good and the greater good of where we live.
Right. No, so that's, I have to say, that's one of the most pithy and succinct and on point definitions I've ever heard. That's fantastic. Mike, what would you kind of add to that or sketch out of that?
I don't use the term community organizer.
Right.
I don't say that's what I do. I just say organizer, or I say power organizer. Because while we obviously organize with and through communities, we organize across other kinds of denominations, faith groups, institutions, geographies. So when we began the Nehemiah effort to build the thousands of single family homes in Brooklyn back in 1983, with a young congressman, by the way, named Charles Schumer, who was a supporter then and is now going to be the leader, Senate Majority Leader. We had an organization in the East Brooklyn community, but we knew that wasn't enough. We needed Bishop Francis J. McGovern. We needed Bishop Robert C. Witcher of the Episcopal Diocese. We needed the Lutheran Church of Missouri Synod. We needed the $8 million they committed in no interest revolving construction money. We needed the New York Daily News, and we needed a developer named I.D. Robbins. So we had to create a power entity that was in with and through the community, but beyond that, and complemented that. So I say we do organize, we do power organizing, and we organize for impact. And the secret is training and is identifying, training, and developing leaders, and figuring out how to bring them together, and sort out differences and agree what we can all tolerate in one another. And then identify those things we want to aim at and affect and change. So that's how I define it.
So because it's been called over the years various things, from institution-based organizing, community organizing. Some refer to faith-based organizing because of the predominance of faith communities. Relational organizing. These are all terms. So for you, the kind of name is less kind of central. It's more this kind of question of how do you bring people together to be able to generate the ability or agency or power, we might say, to affect the conditions they live and work by. And that's going to be for some, in some campaigns, I guess, you know, living wage, it's about working conditions, or now IF's again very involved in union. That's going to be kind of work-based. Other contexts are going to be more place-based. But it's really this question of how do you bring people together to have agency and, love using Keisha's phrase, the kind of joy of discovering your ability to act in the world and act together with others to change and affect for the better your living and working conditions. Would that be a kind of fair sense of what it's about?
Yes. And how do you, there's this term scaling up versus scaling out. How do you scale out the examples of impact that you have in a Cleveland or Chicago or New York or Brooklyn, because we've had enormous impact in certain areas, in certain places. And then funders and others will say, well, you've got to scale it up and you need a bureaucracy and you need a this and a that and a web, you know, whatever, everything. I said, no, you got it wrong. It's not scaling up, it's scaling out. We need 100 Nehemiahs in the U.S., not a couple. We need 100 healthcare, statewide healthcare efforts as we have in Massachusetts, not just one, you know? So how do you scale out? And how do you, in a way, it's agitating and challenging our own people to say, look, we've done something here that's great. Now, how do we replicate it with changes, with modifications, with sensitivity to local conditions in different places, in 100 or 200 or 300 or 500 places. So that's what I kind of think about these days.
No, that's a very helpful response. I mean, I think one of the kind of critiques that's often leveled at organizing, right, going back to the 60s, is this question of scale. And first, it used to be called neighborhood organizing, and then the neighborhood was the wrong scale. So it had to be at the metro scale. And then, well, you need to move to the regional, and then it was the national. And
right.
Now we have various kind of bonkers academic theorists like me saying, oh, you got to be, it's the global scale. And that's the kind of, and so what's
right.
The there's always a bigger scale that you're not fulfilling, but then
cosmic.
Yeah. That really is my job. I teach divinity, so you know that really is that's a given. We're all operating at that level. But that sense of your response there, you were saying this problem of what again geographers call a scalar imagination, that somehow there's always the right scale to have effective agency at. That's the wrong way to look about it. It's about the distribution. And replication, rather than finding some magic bullet scale which will somehow change everything if you just can hit that note.
I think that's right, and you know we have some examples of this when the colleges were being formed in the 1820s and 30s in the Midwest by abolitionists, by religious organizations, by the United Methodists, by others. There's a whole network of Grinnell and Oberlin and Antioch, a whole network of colleges that were open to women at the time, that were abolitionist at the time. They were into STEM, they were into engineering and pragmatic things. There was no hierarchy that said let's build 50 colleges, but they scaled out right. In that period. Same thing happened with high schools, public high schools in the U.S. Same thing happened with community colleges. So how do we do that in organizing, I guess, is a question I have.
So
yeah,
Keisha.
That resonates. Well, I was just wondering, that resonates because for me, coming from Milwaukee and really experiencing our work around Milwaukee Rising, which we really learned from Nehemiah Housing, and then we created an insurance company, coming to Cleveland, that helped give me an imagination about what could be possible. So I think it's scaling out, but it's also imagination. And then having the ability to take that imagination and turn it into some sense of reality, and then learn from the things that we've done, and then figure out how do we make it contextually here, and you know, that works here, but it still has the same flavor. That this was created by the people because this is what we imagine and dream that we need in our community. And we have examples that it can be done.
So that, I guess that part of the imagination then of organizing is it's got to be attentive to the people in a place. And as soon as one gets caught in this imagination of what's the right, this grand scale, one is then immediately removing the answer and the agency from people. So that there's a kind of double whammy there.
Absolutely.
So Keisha, can I ask you what
that's called franchising. That's not our
So that's the idea. You take this kind of identity kit and you can just replicate rather than it grows, it kind of deeply attentive to the people of a place. That's really interesting. So Keisha, let me ask you, so what do you see as the kind of primary goals of being an organizer and of the kind of coalitions you're building? What if you're not doing, would you think your work would lose its heart and soul?
Yeah, I think when I look at our work, I think it's this concept of we the people. And so that there is a people and that there's a sense of a we and a collective. And I think if we lose that sense that it's just about winning, it's just about like the next, you know, hot campaign or the next great trend, and that the people become an expense to those things, I think we've lost the soul of what we're doing. And that, you know, coming into Cleveland, it's not about what I want to do. It's about what we want to do. And What does Reverend Maxwell want to do? Reverend Quincy, Reverend Colvin, or our strategy team? Yes, I have ideas because I come with experience and I'm a part of a collective that's doing really interesting work. But that has to be something we, the people, want to do. And then we begin to do that.
So is part of then the work of organizing is both the identification of what that we is willing to act and act together on, but also the formation and constructing and nourishing of a we, the sense that there is a we here who can act together. Is that right?
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Right. And Mike, what some sense that often there's a focus on the campaigns and we can look at Nehemiah House or Living Wage or these kinds of issues. My sense is, though, that the campaigns, while vital, are kind of secondary at some level to, going back to what you said earlier, to the identification of leaders, the building up of relations, and in many ways, what Keisha said of the formation of a we and the sense of there being a we. Can you just kind of comment and reflect on that a little bit in terms of your experience of doing that?
Yeah, I it's dynamic. It's not a contradiction. I think we do have to win. I want to win. And the people I work with want to win. So the process is important, but impact's important too. And, they're not contradictions, but they are in some tension, in some dynamic tension. It all starts with what we always call organizing. The organizer's job is is a talent scout. So whenever I'm out organizing, I'm looking for talent. I'm looking for strong, tough, interesting, challenging leaders with followers who can become part of a team over time and relate to one another and figure out what they want to do and go after it. So partly it's identifying that talent and not rushing that, and not in the early stages suspending judgment on what I think or anyone thinks might be possible, and making sure the team is there. The right team, because in my experience, with the right team, enormous gains are possible. And without it, no matter what your ideas and thoughts and dreams, you're stuck. Way back when I was starting in Chicago, before I was with the IAF, I was with something called the Campaign Against Pollution, which was an environmental group. And a fellow organizer there was a friend. We were out for dinner one night, and we were finishing dinner. And I said, "I got to go." He said, "Where are you going?" I said, "Well, I've got three individual meetings with three leaders." He says, "Why are you doing that?" I said, "Well, I thought that's what we were supposed to. I thought that's what organizers did." He said, No. I've got a leader who can speak about the environmental issue. She's really good. So I'm done." And you don't need more than one or two. He went on to become a very well-known progressive campaigner and political figure. And it just struck me that he had a totally different picture of what organizing is. His idea of organizing was having these ideas, which are I thought were good ideas too, finding a leader from a community who could be the spokesperson, and then just going ahead. Instead of broadening and deepening the team and finding all the other things that people felt strongly about and might want to work on.
Right.
So it's doing that.
Right. So Keisha, can you comment on there seems to be this tension then. You've got to build relationship, and in some ways you can't let the position or the work get ahead of the strength and depth of the relationships. You've got a kind of move to action. There's got to be some action and some change there as well. And there's a sense in which you've got to build relationship between people who might not otherwise come together or know each other or might be suspicious of each other or even quite antagonistic to each other. How do you manage those elements? Or there might be other elements that, as you see it in your work, but how do you manage those elements as kind of key elements of the organizing labor?
Yeah, I think it is about relationships. So when Mike talked about building the team, it's not about having a team that always agrees, you know, with each other and are the same, thinks the same, wants to be the same. That's not it. I think it, so part of it is being able to identify the people that do have the sense of relationality and know that we need each other to, and I agree, I think we do need to win. We don't always win, but like winning in our work is healing. Like that it is a healing part of being, when you're in a community where you're constantly getting your teeth kicked in or the knee on your neck, winning is a part of healing. And so I think that, you know, the way we've dealt with it is that you got to confront people. So the sense of that we name it, that we're not passive aggressive with each other, that when we say things that might upset us or that we call each other out on that, and that the relationships are there because we know we have the same goal in mind, that if we want to make our community better, we need each other to do that. And the people that are not interested in that are really not attracted to our kind of work. They don't stay. They come for an issue or the thing they want to do, and then when it's done, they leave on. The people that are, they're with these organizations longer than the organizer is, because the organization is their organization. And they know that it's their, you know, business to be growing, finding new leaders, engaging people in this work. And so I think it's the constant struggle of the work. And it's also an appreciation of that. So,
So we're in this time, there's quite, you know, a moment of political ferment, particularly this past 4 years of Trump's presidency. And there's a whole range of responses to that politically. Some people on the street, some people doing kind of policy, trying to reimagine policy approaches. You know, we could go on and on about the different kinds of responses, the different visions of change. How does organizing compare and contrast to other visions and approaches to democratic politics?
Yeah, I think that, so one of the things about, like, if you look at the Black Lives Matter protests that, you know, happened in 2020, and that kind of protest, people compare that to 1968. That, you know, then led to the Voter Rights Act. That kind of protest does play a role, I think, in our civic democratic world, because there is real outrage and disgust of the oppression and the injustice, particularly, you know, the killing of Black bodies and or in the civil rights, the oppression of Black people to be able to be able to move and buy and work. And so that outrage is necessary and useful. The question then becomes, what after that? And the people that go to those, you know, protests and like, this was a great experience, now what? Like, or I'm so angry, now what? I think that our work is a space for that, the now what, because we do build these organizations to last and to take that hot anger that you experience in a protest and turn it into co-anger that is focused on relationships and building power so we can get wins, right, and that we can make that progress that we need to make. And so that's what I say, you know, go do it, experience it. And if it's not enough, or if you're looking for something more, we're here. And then I think for us that becomes, you know, creating that space to think about, okay, yeah, you can do relational meetings over Zoom. That was a huge epiphany for us. And I can tell you, if I would have had a young organizer come to me and say, like, okay, I'm going to do all my individual meetings on Zoom, like, well, you're not going to work with us. but now, you know, in this world of COVID, I've done relational meetings on Zoom, and I actually see that you can build relationships. And so I think there's that sense for us to be open to the digital world, this digital realm, and kids that grow up in this space, and be able to complement those kinds of experiences with the real relationships, the sense of like doing power analysis, doing the strategy, having those meetings, learning how to mix it up with power people, right, and engage and move and push.
Right.
So that's what I would say.
It leads into, there's been quite a lot of talk around, and often there's a distinction made between organizing and mobilizing. And in recent years, past decade or so, we've seen very powerful protest movements emerge, whether it's the Arab Spring or the earlier iteration of Black Lives Matter, and the way social media can enable people to quickly find each other and be mobilized. And then that's often contrasted with organizing. And we can think back to the first presidential election campaign of Barack Obama, who many would say combined this kind of online mobilizing space and kind of on the ground organizing very effectively in his campaign to bring together a kind of much broader coalition than historically had been kind of mobilized or brought together for electoral purposes. So can you both comment for me on that distinction between mobilizing and organizing, whether it's in an online space or more broadly. And in organizing terms, is often framed quite negatively. Organizing is the good thing, mobilizing is the bad thing. I think it's a less clear-cut thing today, but I'd be interested to hear your reflections on that distinction, why it matters, what's at stake in it.
Yeah. So when I came to GCC, GCC has Greater Cleveland congregation, a really strong mobilizing culture. It was able to mobilize the organization and the city to pass a levy for the school district when it hadn't done that in 10 years. It was a part of a coalition to get Medicaid. So in our organizing, we do mobilizing. It plays a role. And I think when I seen the distinction when I was in Milwaukee and we, Deacon Alex Hardy, we had our 10-year anniversary to launch our new vision. And Deacon Hardy was standing outside and he has this list of 97 people that were confirmed to come. And he's standing there and he's checking each one off. And to me, that was like organizing was because he had conversations with those people. They committed to coming and he was looking for them to be there. And then he thanked all of them for coming. And so I think that, in this moment, there's an opportunity for both. The organizing work is more specific, more deliberate, and it's harder. It's easy to post something on Facebook and hope people come. And now people do, but then the question becomes what next? And if we have the next action, who's going to be there? And how am I going to organize those people to get them there?
All right. Mike, do you want to add some kind of some reflections on that distinction?
Sure. Well, and I throw in a third category, service, because I think and I do a little matrix on this. There are three ways to respond to things, and they're all meaningful and appropriate at different times. So, simple story, if there was a car crash outside our houses right now, and we heard a crash and an incident, we'd stop this podcast and we'd go out. And if someone was in trouble, we'd help them and provide a service, I think. If it happened three times in a day, we might call our block meeting and get together and have a little demonstration or a press conference and say, hey, the city's got to fix this street. It's very dangerous. If it happened as it did in Brooklyn some years ago, in 100 different areas in East Brooklyn, a press conference won't work. A quick gathering won't work. You need to pull together leaders from different areas, do an analysis of where the incidents happened, compare the street traffic signals and whatnot to the same signals in wealthy areas, and then go after the city and the state and get it corrected, which we did. So in each situation calls for a response that's right for that situation. Long-term, sustainable efforts, not only to win, but to preserve the win. It's not just you can get a yes And if you don't have a power organization, that yes goes away. And we've seen that again and again. So to have a long-term sustained effective change, you need organizing. And I think the other power establishments are very comfortable with service. And I actually think they're comfortable with mobilizing. They can withstand bad press and large scale demonstrations. They got that covered. They can't withstand organizing in the long term.
Yeah. No, and I think that's a very good point. And I think there is a rather nasty way in which, particularly in the online space, the mobilizing is actually producing coin for the people who own those spaces. And that, I think, is a thing that is increasingly we're having to reckon with about the outrage machine has been monetized to kind of make a lot of...
We during the Arab Spring, we asked three of our organizers, Lena Jamul, Yusuf Yivali, and another one, to go to go there and to learn about the effort. And they had and what they learned was, yes, technology had been helpful, but there had been organizing going on among taxi drivers and different work groups for a decade. Right. And that organizing had come together in the Arab Spring. That's the one thing. The other thing they learned is the opposition began to use technology as effectively as the uprising was using it, and undermine the effort with some of the same tools. So it's a tool, not an end.
There's a very old argument in kind of organizing, mobilizing debates that goes back to, I think the kind of historic example is the Detroit workers strike in the 1930s or something. This is a kind of probably very obscure labor history, but the sense in which a real change emerges spontaneously. People somehow get together at a moment of crisis and they generate these solutions to themselves. And if you have a organizer or any intentional effort, that somehow dilutes or is an imposition. And there's quite a lot of academic talk about that kind of thing. There's this ideal of that real change emerges spontaneously within organizing efforts. I think it's baloney personally. I just think the evidence, empirical evidence, that there's always organizing efforts that have been going on, even if they're very informal and the kind of building of a relational power base. But I know, Mike, you've had that. You must have had that thrown at you a lot. Like, how do you respond to that kind of critique or comment?
It's mythology. It's not history. It's the mythology of Rosa Parks, that she was a wonderful woman who finally got fed up and decided to sit where she wanted to sit. And completely erases her training at the Highlander Center and the fact that she tried the same tactic several times before she got the reaction that got the attention that they were seeking. It's just mythology. And maybe an aversion to the work, what Keisha referred to, the work side of this. This is work. That's not a negative. But it's a reality that hobbyists, as Eitan Hirsch has described people, they don't want to work. They want to pop in and pop out at their leisure. That's not how change happens. But it's good work. But it's work.
That connection to civil rights.
So, Luke, I just wanted to add to that. Yeah. Like, I think that mythology benefits the dominant culture to say that if you can mythologize it, then you can dismiss the real like existential threat that organizing is to the status quo. Right. Like at the end of the day, I think when I look at what our organizations do is we are this existential threat to the status quo. And so it works to say Rosa Parks was just fed up. And but what doesn't work is that it was all these African Americans and their relationships that organized their money. Because actually, when you look at the boycott and the money that was lost from the city, and they took that power and changed it, like, that's a real threat.
And I think crucially there that they took what was to hand. And that's part of organizing work, is they could organize their money. They had some, they had cars, they had institutions of the church to kind of to make connections. And so the organizing work is, it's, I love the, I know Ernie Cortez sometimes uses the parable of the feeding of the 5,000 and kind of does a reinterpretation of it. But that, that sense of that, that transformative event emerged out of people taking what was to hand and it becoming more because it was amplified and increased by people doing it together. And I think the Montgomery bus boycott is a wonderful, just a very powerful example of that. So Mike, can I ask you, where does organizing come from? What are some of the kind of streams, rivers of traditions of political work, of forms of life that feed into the kind of development of this thing we've been talking about as organizing work?
Well, you know, let me tell you that with respond to that with a specific and it's similar to maybe to Keisha's, and it relates to your last question, Luke, about the connection between mobilizing and organizing. Over 30 years ago, we found a young fellow in New York named Dave Fleischer, and he was working for Ruth Messenger as a borough president. He was a partisan political person, a publicly gay. And I can't remember how we met initially, but we met, we did several individual meetings, and I said, why don't you come work for us? We're nonpartisan, so it's not for partisan work, but why don't you come and teach our leaders in New York how to do voter turnout, in local elections. So Dave worked for us for 3 years and taught us voter mobilization, and then went on to Ohio 10, 12 years ago, and worked with our groups with an effort there. But then Dave, after a couple of years, said, you know, I really love this, and I love the IIF and the leaders I'm working with, but I want to work on gay and lesbian issues. And so he went and did that. And he took what he learned from organizing and applied it to how to engage people in what's called deep canvassing now, which is now widely recognized as highly important work. And he helped turn around all of the all the attacks on gay and lesbian policies and people. Remember, 15 years ago, the gay and lesbian community was in retreat, was being beaten time and again in local elections and referenda. Dave and his team reversed that, turned that around, and turned it into a long list of victories. So it's another way that Dave is an organizer, and I consider him part of an extended Industrial Areas Foundation team and a close colleague and close friend who probably would say I do more mobilizing than organizing, but they're very interconnected and they feed one another. He's fed us, and I think we've fed him.
Right.
So I think that's the way it works times, at its best, actually.
Right. No, that's really helpful. There's another great example. And I think the deep canvassing kind of process is incredibly important at this time of polarization. So just going back to that, what I was saying about the history, what do you see as the different strands feeding into this? Can you narrate for us a little bit about how would you tell something of that history or story?
Well, in our history, as you know, John L. Lewis was the mentor to Saul Alinsky. So one of the deepest early streams was organized labor and its history. The Back of the Yards, the first IIF organization, was an organization of congregations and labor unions and civic groups and community groups. So there was a civic stream. There was a labor stream. There was a religious stream. And it, operating in pretty much equal parts for a long time. Civil rights movement was part of that, a big part of it. Civil rights leaders were part of the IAF board at early stages. Ed Chambers, who passed away, was the former executive director, was at the founding event of the Birmingham Association in the 50s. Not as an organizer, but as a observer and an interested person. So all the Mexican American farm workers movement and community service organizations were part of the early formation of the IAF. Fred Ross Sr. and Cesar Chavez were on the IAF payroll in the early days for a while. So all of those movements, ethnic and racial developments and entities kind of fed in to the IAF. Around the 70s and 80s, labor and IAF went separate ways, not in opposition and not in hostility, just out of kind of drift. And then in the late 90s and 2000s, we brought it back together again through the Living Wage Campaign and the Amalgamated Transit Union work and the work with the education associations and others. So there have been kind of phases of IAF's history, but all informed by those early groups, those early leaders, and those early lessons.
Yeah. So one of the things, and it's been a kind of thread through our conversation today, is the role of religious institutions and religious leaders have been key in both of your lives, you know, and then the backdrop to your own getting involved in organizing. Why do you think organizing has and religious institutions have kind of found each other? What's going on there? Why do you think religious institutions they're not exclusive to organizing, and we've talked about other kinds of institutions get involved, but they have been a kind of backbone and provided a kind of ballast over decades in all the organizations. Can you both of you talk to, and if I begin with you, Keisha, you know, why do you think religious institutions have been particularly important to organizing and continue to be?
Yeah, well, I think that we bring out the best in each other. So in a sense of with congregations, a lot of our organizers come out of institutions. There's generations of organizers now that are coming into this that don't come out of institutions. And so I think that sense of really the imago Dei, that we're made in the image of God, and that it's the growth and development of people that is our sacred work. And also the sense that for us to multiply ourselves, and so that we need to grow and develop. And so I think that religion, like religious institutions, I think has helped shape that piece. And then the organizing, I think, helps to animate that sense around justice. Right. Of if this value of justice, how do you then really do that in this world? And experience what that means, and what does it mean to experience injustice, to then challenge that to create change.
So Mike, what would be some of your reflections on that question about the importance of religious institutions to organizing?
Yeah, I guess I take one step maybe a little further back. I think all really vital institutions do three things. I think they offer places for people to relate. I think they offer places for people to learn. And then they offer places for where people can act effectively and with impact. And I think that kind of the overlapping elements of quality organizing and religious institutions, those three activities kind of operate. So in many of our congregations, our ministers and our top lay leaders, they want to relate to more people. Yeah. I mean, they love their institution and they're committed to it and all that. But after a while, it can be narrow. Right. In fact, it is narrow, whether it's no matter what faith, what denomination. So there's this appetite to relate.
Right.
And talented people really enjoy relating across race and class and faith and geography. So the organizing gives people in congregations that opportunity.
Right. So what, Keisha, just help me understand kind of What do you think some of the things community organizing is particularly good at, and what are some of its limits? I mean, I don't want to kind of say this is the great panacea to all political change, because it's not. You know, it's a bit of the picture. It's important not to have a sense of, you know, not to be hubristic about it. So, like, what do you think is the thumbs it's particularly good at, and what do you think are some of its limits in your experience?
Yeah, so I'd say I am biased. I mean, I'm doing this half the amount of time that Mike is. I think I'm in 20 years, he's in 40. And so
a bit more. I think.
For me, I think, okay. Not quite half, almost half. But I think the good part of it is that we build these organizations to last and to be institutions that are generational. So that, like our congregations, like labor unions. So I think that's a good part. I think some of the limitations is this rap that we get of not collaborating with other people, that we go it alone. And I think the other is that sometimes it's too slow and too deep. Like, it's slow, not very sexy. I think organizing in Cleveland has given me a real sense of the need to have allies. And so I would say, like, you know, while there's a pushback that we don't collaborate, I think we're really clear about allies and that we can't do the work that we do on our own. Like, we need other relationships of other people with influence, like the crisis centers that we just, you know, won in Cleveland, almost $20 million put to that. That was because of, you know, relationships that we built with the county prosecutor and the judges and the foundations, and some of the local mental health groups. And so I think that we get a bad rap for that. I would say another thing that we're probably bad at is not really celebrating. So when Mike said, you know, like, win, that's important, preserving the win, we don't do a good job of stopping to, like, really celebrate, like, what we've to, like, savor the right, like, the struggle that we went through to get to that point. And the other part is a sense of rest and rejuvenation, because people that are, I think, drawn to this work are angry and they're ambitious and they're tireless. And so I think that sense of, you know, what I've appreciated about my colleagues and Metro IF is that the sense of, like, when are you taking a vacation? And a vacation is not just a week. It's 3 weeks. It's 4 weeks. It's like, are you putting your family first in your schedule? But that's a constant tension, you know, in this work. And I think as we try to attract the next generation to this work, to say, like, it is work. Yeah. But there should also be times of rest and rejuvenation and celebration.
Right. I think there's a very deep insight in that. Politics is not the whole of life, and it has limits. And that kind of biblical call of Sabbath rest places a limit on work. It's not just only so much you can achieve, but there is a proper end to doing the work, and there are other things to be done. And I think that's a very important kind of check on all, because one of our problems at the moment is politics invades everything, and everything gets sucked into the maw of politics, and that itself is a quite a dehumanizing process, I think. So Mike, what would you see some of the things it's really good at, but also some of its limits?
Well, I'll start with a limit. I agree with Keisha. Pace. The limit is pace. Can we go faster, scale out more, be in more places, properly replicate in more places? And that's a function of recruiting organizers, which I think has been episodic and not as aggressive as it needs to be. So when I started organizing, you know, way, way back, we knew from day one that we had to recruit other organizers, that there was nobody else. There were no senior people. There were nobody. You had to do it. And then we did it. And then that became habit. I think that's not, I mean, that's got to be reignited in the next generation of organizers. They've got to be recruiting all the time. So I think it's pace, and I think it's related to the level of intensity that is applied to recruiting good, strong organizers and getting them out in the field and letting them make their mistakes. And then, as we talked about earlier, it's organizing is capable of securing major improvements and protecting them and preserving them.
Want to just some final reflections on what do you think are the kind of biggest threats and opportunities to organizing in not just in the immediate moment as we change governments, but in the kind of in a kind of 5-year window, like as you look ahead, what do you think of some of the kind of key threats and opportunities to the kind of work that you both committed yourself to?
I think our biggest threat is to attract and retain, train and retain organizers, particularly younger, particularly people of color, also white, Jewish, whatever, but that next generation, the people that are coming behind me. And so, you know, as I think about this and that becomes a huge part of my work of raising the money, like I got into this, I was able to, Ernie Cortez was trying out 14 organizers in LA. It was kind of nuts and like crazy, but he organized the money to do that. And there's five of us that came out of that are still in this organizing 20 years later. And so I think that, you know, is on us to attract and retain. So some the work that Mike has done but there's other places like that, that we have to do that, but we also have to raise the money to pay those people well so they could take care of their families. I think the opportunities honestly are limitless because we're in this moment of the breaking down of so many institutions of work, of family, of community, a global pandemic. And when you look in history, like some of the greatest things that shifted in organizing came out of these like moments of things being unearthed. And like, who are the people that step into those chasms to recast a vision and a focus and to really build. And so I'm ecstatic that I'm, you know, in my 40s in this moment, in this organization with the relationships we have and clear about what our threats are, but then also really clear about what our opportunities are.
All right.
I think the other, you know, challenge or threat is that a lot of our work has been in institutions, faith institutions, and we know that they're declining like across the board. And so the sense of how are we looking at other institutions or even people that are not a part of, you know, the kind of traditional institution that I was, and engaging them, you know, in this work and attracting them. Yeah.
Leo Penta, who organized in Berlin, he set up an institution for people who won't join institutions.
Right.
Yes. We did that. I think
there's going to be increasingly like the institution was for people who, well, I don't want to be part of an institution. Well, okay. Well, it's an institution.
I was there when we did that. All right. Leo did that. And we had a famous meeting in a pub where we met with these young people and they wanted to be part of the organization, but they didn't want to be part of an institution. I said, well, why don't you call yourself the anti-institution institution? And so they got really quiet. Then one guy said, but then we'd be an institute. So they joined.
I know, I've always loved that story. It's brilliantly speaks to so many where so many people are at, you know, but then they're attracted to the work. So just want to close out and thank you so much, Mike and Keisha, for talking with me today here on the Listen, Organize, Act podcast. And it's been a very, very rich conversation. I think we've kind of opened out many aspects of organizing, which the subsequent series will explore in taking up different elements of what we've talked through today. So thank you again, and really, really great to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you, Keisha. Good to see you. Good to see you both.
Yeah, thank you, Mike. Thank you.
Take care.
Thank you for joining me for this episode of the Listen, Organize, Act podcast, in which I explored the question, what is community organizing? I hope you join me next time as I continue this journey through the different elements of community organizing and how it embodies a distinctive vision of democratic politics.